Good evening. Thank you so much for being here. We have members, we have visitors. All are welcome, as is always the case. We referred you to the book of Proverbs and chapter 1 particularly by way of introduction here this morning, this morning. I took the liberty of preaching three sermons instead of one, and I didn't get any flack for it at all. So tonight, no telling how many sermons I'm going to preach. I think it's four or five anyway, and they're going to be shorter than the other ones, so don't worry so much. We'll get out of here plenty of time. But I've been trying to find an opportunity to do something kind of like this for a while. Proverbs, as I often say with all kinds of different books, is one of my favorites, and one of the things about Proverbs is that it's so difficult to develop a theme, as it were. The Proverbs tend to kind of stand on their own. There are exceptions to that. But generally speaking, Proverbs are just sayings. It's like reading, the dictionary. There's one thing, and there's another thing, and sometimes there's a connection, and most of the time there's not. And so it becomes difficult to have a sermon on Proverbs. What I'd like to do this evening is preach several little small sermons on Proverbs along the general theme of layered learning, I guess you might say. When we read from Proverbs chapter 1, Solomon describes the process of Proverbs and the meaning behind Proverbs. He talks about to know wisdom and instruction, to understand the sayings of understanding. The idea is that we are encouraged to dig into the book and find relevance, find meaning, find application. And somebody says, well, what makes that so different from any other book of the Bible? And that's a good point. But Proverbs, maybe even more than most of the other books, if not all of the other books, is written in such a way as to encourage the reader to come back. Now, there is a sense, of course, in which you can read Matthew, or you can read Acts, you can read Jeremiah, or whatever, and you read it through, and you get all kinds of spiritual learning and discernment, and then you come back a month later, and you read it through again, and you get a whole other set of insights and knowledge, and you grow, and you grow, and you grow in your appreciation of that book in particular, and the Word of God in general. And you can do that with any book of the Bible. That's certainly true. Proverbs, though, is rather unique in the sense that it seems to have been written specifically for that purpose. That there is a surface meaning to what this general, and a proverb is just kind of a saying. It's a word of wisdom. And you take this and, hey, that's a good thought, and I'm going to have to remember that. And you put it to work in your life. And then later on, you find out that you were tricked by Solomon or by your father, whoever it was that taught you this proverb, that's not actually what you were learning about. Now, I remember there was a commercial, a public service announcement kind of thing. Derek Jeter, the Yankee shortstop, was talking about the lessons that he had learned while playing Little League, and that you keep your head down, you stay focused, you go where the coach tells you to do. If the ball jumps up at it will not hurt you. And at the end of it, he says, my father taught me all these lessons. And the funny thing was, all that time, I thought he was talking about baseball. And, he was talking about life. And you realize that later on. Baseball is kind of famous for that. Well, Proverbs is famous for that too, and rightly so. And in fact, Solomon's use of the word riddle is kind of interesting, and I find intriguing, verse number 6, to understand a proverb and a figure, the words of the wise, and their riddles. And there have been and you can get overly intellectual about any aspect of God's word, and that includes Proverbs. I understand that. But there does seem to be a sense in which you can unpeel Proverbs a little bit and find not only this surface meaning, which is perfectly valuable in and of itself, but this deeper meaning also that is applying to this other aspect of life that's even more important than the other. And what I'd like to do is give you a few examples of what I see as this sort of writing pattern in Proverbs, and hopefully it will encourage you to dig a little bit deeper and to understand the riddles yourself. And this is by no means an exhaustive list, but it's a few of the Proverbs that I jotted down. The first one is Proverbs 29, verse number 1. And we'll start with a relatively simple one. A man who hardens his neck after much reproof will suddenly be broken beyond remedy, rather. What's that talking about? Well, it's not talking about chiropractic care. You know, he's not saying here that if you refuse to move your neck, you're going to wind up breaking your neck. That may not be sound physiological advice. I don't know about that personally. Sister Eubanks is not here to advise us on that. But what it's talking about here is stubbornness. It's talking about willful stubbornness and the hardening of your neck in a metaphorical sort of sense. Now, there is a sense in which you can develop a stiff neck, deliberately or accidentally, where you literally do not move your neck. Maybe you're strapped into a device. Maybe you have some kind of therapeutic thing going on, and you're not able to move your neck. And suddenly that impediment is removed, and you're freed up to move, and you realize that even though you are free, you can't. You know, because your ability to move around is extraordinarily difficult, even when the device is taken off. Your neck is stiff, and it takes a great deal of effort to try to move from one direction to another. And similar things can be said about different parts of the body, but the neck is important because it turns the head, it turns the face, it changes your perspective on things. Well, the word stiff neck, then, it's not surprising that this word is used in the Bible, including in Acts chapter 7, verse 51, as a figure of speech for stubbornness. A person is not physically impaired, but they are emotionally, spiritually, mentally impaired. They are so used to looking at things from a particular perspective, they essentially, practically, render themselves incapable of seeing things any other way. You know, when horses get too distracted, race horses, they get too distracted by the crowds or the other horses or whatever. Sometimes the owners will put blinders on the horses. You know, these little cup things right here, where they're incapable of seeing anything other than what's straightforward. It's an artificial way of getting them to focus on the things that are right ahead. Human beings sometimes do that to themselves. We're so used to a certain perspective that we find it incapable. Find ourselves incapable of bending, of changing our perspective, of looking at things from other people's perspectives. It's a form of stubbornness, essentially. And what we find is that if a person develops these stubborn characteristics, they tend to become more and more stubborn. Now, this is a stereotype for elderly people, but you can make the same kind of observation for pretty much anybody in any kind of demographic group. If you don't train yourself to look around from side to side, you'll find yourself incapable of looking from side to side if you're not careful. And clearly, God wants us to be able to sympathize with others. He wants us to be able to perceive the world that is around us in a real and meaningful way. And especially in the sense that there is perhaps a danger, there is perhaps a blessing, some aspect of our life that we need to take note of, that we're incapable of taking note of because it's over here, or it's over here, and it's outside of our very, very narrow self-inflicted view, vision of the world. Ezekiel is informed about this. Ezekiel is told that he is going to go and preach to a very stubborn people, and you know, as far as pep talks go, this probably wasn't one of the greatest that was ever delivered. God is telling Ezekiel, here's your job. You need to go out there and preach to these people, and I want to tell you right offhand that they're not going to be very interested in what you have to say. They're a stubborn people. They are stiff-necked. And we encounter that when we take the gospel to a lost and dying world. We oftentimes find that they have become so entrenched in their own mentality, their own perspective, that they are not interested and appear incapable, in fact, of looking at things from a different perspective, to challenge their own preconceived notions. People will do that sometimes. And our duty, as was the duty of Ezekiel, is to continue to preach the truth, continue to challenge them and give them opportunities to change, because who knows, they may be able to change in the end, despite our worst expectations. Now, the problem with this is, if we don't challenge our preconceptions, and we're talking primarily about our own here, if you don't challenge your own thinking, then the problem is that your condition is going to worsen. And it talks about the neck that doesn't bend is going to break one of these days. And again, I'm not sure exactly how true that is physiologically, but it's very true spiritually. That if you become so narrow in your perceptions, you will get to the point where instead of choosing to turn to see another point of view, God's going to take your head and yank it to the side and force you to see, and it's not going to be very pleasant, and you may not survive the experience. So what we want to do is make sure that we do not put ourselves in that kind of position. The moral of the story essentially here is that we are supposed to be open to correction. Certainly correction from God, but also correction from people who have God's word. Now, sometimes we get correction directly from the word, and sometimes people take us to the word and have us have the truth shown to us. Galatians chapter 6 and verse number 1 says that the godly one, the spiritual one, is to correct his brother in the spirit of gentleness, lest he also be tempted. So when we find correction coming our way, when somebody is kind of taking us by the ears and turning our head a little bit, we're not going to especially enjoy that experience. You're not supposed to enjoy it. But you appreciate it because you know that somebody cares enough about you, whether it's the preacher or the elders or your parents or whoever. They care enough about you to help you see something that you would not have seen otherwise that may save your life, may improve your life. And instead of reacting negatively toward this correction, toward this help, instead see it as a positive kind of thing. Now, sometimes somebody will take you by the ears and turn your neck because they want to cause you pain. And it really doesn't have anything to do with whether you're going to be better off or not. That's the world we live in. You know, we even have brethren who are like that, unfortunately. The job that we have as formerly stiff-necked people is not to reject this correction simply because the person has a bad attitude. Our job is to assume in the first place that they have a good attitude. And the second place, even if it's proved to us that they don't have a good attitude, that doesn't mean they're not showing us something that we need to see. And so take advantage of the good correction, take advantage of the bad correction. Do whatever it takes to break away from our preconceived notions and find what the real truth is rather than what we perceive truth already to be in our own minds. That's one example. I'll give you another one. In Proverbs chapter 22 and verse 28, this is one of my favorites. Do not move the ancient boundary which your fathers have set. And that's all there is to it. There is no other surveying information in that context. I'm a big fan of context here, and this is talking about whose property is whose. You know, nowadays you would go to the assessor's office or wherever it is that they keep records of land, land property, such, and or you go into your files and find that gigantic stack of paperwork that they gave you when you signed for your house, right? And somewhere in there, there's a plat, you know, and there's an actual marking of where your land starts and where your land ends, and whether your neighbor's rose bushes are in fact infringing upon your property, or whether he's, you know, trying to build a shed on your property, or you're building one on his. We need to get these things straight every once in a while, and it would not be appropriate for me to take my eraser out and kind of erase one of those lines and kind of draw it in again, give myself another 6 feet or so. That's not kosher. You're not supposed to do that. That's illegal. And it was illegal back then as well. In Deuteronomy chapter 19, before the land was ever distributed, the Moses is telling the people there, when God gives you this land in the land of Canaan, verse number 14, that this allotment was from God and that boundaries were going to be set up. Physical boundaries. Not necessarily fences, but probably more likely posts. A big rock in the ground or stack of rocks. And you know, you follow your eye line from this stack of rocks to that other stack of rocks, half a mile down there. This is the property line. And what's on this line is mine, and what's on that line is his. And if I want, I can sneak out in the middle of the night and move the pile of rocks and move it over 6 inches, you know, and move the other pile of rocks 6 inches. And then, you know, a week later, move it another 6 inches. I could do that if I wanted to, and maybe in a sneaky sort of way, steal a whole bunch of property. Well, you're not supposed to do that. These boundaries were put in place deliberately by the will of God, and you're supposed to respect that. Now, that's the surface meaning of this idea of not moving the ancient boundaries. Now, I'm willing to bet that if you've heard this passage quoted in sermons by me or some other preacher, it was not in regard to stealing people's real estate. It was probably more of a spiritual kind of thing. And I think that's an appropriate use of the text here because there is deeper meaning behind this than simply respecting physical boundary lines. This is talking about respecting traditions, respecting the moral boundaries, the spiritual boundaries that have been laid down, whether they are the laws that God has given us or whether they are the traditions that are based on those laws that have upheld God's laws for all of these years. We have all kinds of traditions. in the Lord's church today, in my family, in your family. Some of those traditions change. Some of them don't change. Some of them we bind as law. Some of them we don't. But all of them, hopefully, are intended to keep us on the straight and narrow. They're intended to keep us in the ways of God. And by changing things, we run the risk of running afoul of God's word. Now, realize, of course, changing human traditions and changing God's traditions are two different things. We understand that. But that's not to say that we can just go willy-nilly through. Well, you know, we used to have a service that was an hour long in the morning and an hour long in the evening, but now we're going to change things because, you know, we shouldn't be wed tradition. So now we're going to have a 3-hour service in the morning and a 10-minute service in the evening. Well, we can do that, I guess. You want to do that? Well, why do you want to do that? Well, just because it'll be different. Well, it'll be different, all right. Yeah, it's you can check that box, okay? But are you accomplishing anything with this? Are we drawing closer to God because of this? Generally speaking, I think this is fair to say, regardless of the value that the rules and the traditions have in our everyday lives today, that they were laid down for a reason. That there was a reason that some elder in the Lord's church at East Hill 50 years ago or whatever decided that this was going to be the way it was, or that this was going to be the way that it was. And there was a reason for that. And generally, it was a spiritual reason. That doesn't mean you do things differently down the street, then you're all going to go to hell. But why do we have Bible classes, for instance? Well, we have Bible classes because if you don't have Bible classes in the Lord's church, you're going to go to hell. You're not a real church if you don't have Bible classes. No, that's not it. We have Bible classes because we want to learn about the Bible, right? Well, maybe we can cancel our Bible classes. Well, you know, maybe we can. But why would we do that? And if we do that, what are we doing to replace that? If a particular guideline was put in place to help us stay in God's will, it's because there was a principle that we were trying to defend. It's because of a practice that we were trying to encourage. And if we're not going to do it this way, let's encourage it some other way. Now, this is one of the problems that I have with slimming down services, as it were. I'm not suggesting that the way that we do it or the way that we've always done it is the only way to do it, or that we shouldn't change necessarily. But if we are respecting the need for Christians to gather on Wednesday nights, and the need for Christians to gather on Sunday evenings to further study God's word, to further encourage one another in spiritual things, we can all acknowledge that that's a good thing. That's a needful thing. And if we're not going to do it in that way, let's do it in some other way. But let's not throw the baby out with the bathwater, as it were. The traditions that we are holding to, generally speaking, are good traditions. They can be replaced by other good traditions, sure. But let's not forget why the boundaries were put there in the first place. There are positive examples, there are negative examples of people following after these traditions. 2 John chapter 9, verse number 9 rather, talks about how the one who goes too far, the one who transgresses, does not abide in the will of God, the commandments of God, does not have God. That's the idea of transgressing is a tide term, it's a weather term. That a lake is supposed to stay within its proper boundaries here. That's why you buy the house by the lake instead of half a mile off the lake. You want to be next to the lake. And you're assuming the lake's going to stay where it is, right? Well, if the lake decides to crawl up an extra 20 feet up the shoreline, then you're going to have a problem, right? It's not supposed to be doing that. It's transgressing. It's causing a problem. Well, when we transgress God's law, what we're doing is we're not respecting the boundary that God has laid down. Likewise, in 1 Corinthians 11, verse 2, talks about respecting the tradition that has been laid down by the fathers. And I think that Paul there is talking about inspired tradition. You may differ with me on that, but I think he's talking about inspired tradition there. That God has a will and he's revealed it to us. And again, we may differ a little bit on how we apply that. But let's not quit applying that simply because, well, it's just a pile of rocks after all. You know, the pile of rocks is still going to be a pile of rocks over there as it is over here. Well, maybe it's accomplishing something where it is. And if we're not going to have a pile of rocks, let's have something that's going to accomplish the same purpose. The moral of the story is here that godly traditions uphold godly values. And if the old ways are going to be rejected, then we have to find some new ways that are also going to accomplish the same purposes. Because we would all agree that we need to be building one another up in love and in fellowship and in strength and understanding of God's word. We need to be prayerful people. We need to be studious people. We need to be worshipful people. And if we're not going to pursue them the same way that we've always done it for the last 50 years, 100 years, 500 years, whatever, let's make sure we do it in some other way. Anyway, move on. Speaking of moving boundaries, Proverbs 22, verse 15. Foolishness is bound up in the heart of the child. The rod of discipline will remove it far from him. I am a big fan of spanking. People here know about this. I have waxed eloquent on the wondrous years in my past when I had the privilege of spanking my children. It was a glorious time, and I do not apologize for any of that. Those of you who have heard me speak on this subject may be surprised what I'm about to say. I'm going to say it anyway. Spanking may not be for everybody. Did Hal really say that? Spanking may not be for everybody. Discipline is for everybody. Tracy used to babysit in her youth for a couple of children who were, and this is an extreme example, but the children who were free bleeders, whatever the term is, I forget what the term is called. Hemophiliac, thank you. Hemophiliacs. Where it was literally dangerous for any kind of physical assault to be put upon this child. You know, he stubs his toe. That could be a problem. Fall down a flight of stairs, he's going to the hospital, for sure. And the idea of laying a hand to the child's rear end, regardless of the motives behind it or the scriptural basis of it, was a dangerous kind of thing to do. I'm in favor of putting a parent in the jail for assaulting a child like that when you're endangering a child's health. Nobody wants that. What we do want is discipline. And the notion of discipline being necessary, and it's described here as a rod. By the way, rods were used for things other than hitting stuff and causing pain. Whether you're talking about a sheep or a child or anything. Physical chastening is, yes, a time-honored form of discipline. But there are other forms of discipline. The important thing is not to make sure you spank your children enough times. And I hope that I have never given anybody the impression that there's some kind of quota out there. If you spanked your children 100 times when they were growing up, then you did a good job. If you spanked them 99 times, then they're probably going to go to hell, and it's going to be your fault. That's I don't think the Bible teaches that. I don't see that at all. What we do see is a need for discipline in the home, and for adults too, by the way, and the requirement for parents to administer this discipline because, as the text says here, foolishness is bound up in the heart of the child. No offense, kids. It's not your fault. We don't blame you for this. You just come into this world not knowing what's going on. Not your fault. We don't hate you for it. We don't resent you for it. Or we try not to anyway. It's just the way that it is. It's our job as parents to get it out of you, to train you to not be foolish with the things that you're doing. And some of the lessons take, you know, 10 years, and some of the lessons take maybe 15 years, and some of them, you know, may take longer than that. And that's okay, because we take our job seriously, we're going to do it. We're going to do our job as best we can. Going along with the previous point, however the discipline comes out, and by the way, I would strongly urge you to adjust your discipline. In fact, I don't know how you could manage to not adjust your discipline. Discipline for a 6-month-old, and discipline for a 3-year-old, and discipline for a 12-year-old, and discipline for a 25-year-old look entirely different. But they all need discipline. Hopefully, God will give us enough wisdom to know the difference and know which one is appropriate in any given situation. As the tactics change, as our approach changes, not just from year to year, but from child to child even, maybe appropriate discipline for this child is not the right thing for this other child. But whatever we're doing or not doing, the main objective cannot change. Foolishness is still bound up in the heart of the child, and we still have to administer the rod of discipline to get it out of them. And we have to keep administering it until it is out of them. Paul, or whoever the writer is of Hebrews, deals with the topic of discipline, and I refer to this passage a lot as I consider parenting and such related topics. In Hebrews chapter 12, and you know the text, verse number 7, we'll just pull a little piece of it out here. It is for discipline that you endure. God deals with you as with sons, for what a son is there whom a father does not discipline? You got to do it. That's what parents do. If you're not doing it, then you're not much of a parent, the writer says here. And that's not my words, that's God's words. If you're without discipline, of which we've all become partakers, then you're illegitimate children, not sons. We love our children, that's why we administer the discipline, whatever form it takes. Furthermore, we had earthly fathers to discipline us, and we respected them. Shall we not much rather be subject to the Father's spirits and live? For they disciplined us for a short time as seemed best to them, but he disciplines us for our good, so that we may share his holiness. And going through verse number 11 there, all discipline for the moment seems not to be joyful. You know, tell me about it, the kid says, who just got the spanking, right? But sorrowful. Yet, to those who have been trained by it, afterward it yields the peaceful fruit of righteousness. You're not supposed to enjoy discipline. You're not supposed to enjoy administering discipline. And I don't, regardless of whatever kind of cracks I make on the subject. But what we do appreciate is that we are taking place in a necessary part, an essential part of our job as parents. And not just a parent monitoring a child, a parent disciplining a child, but elders disciplining the congregants, God disciplining us directly. We understand this is a process that is necessary. And if you decide that grounding your children doesn't work, that doesn't mean you quit disciplining your children. It means you find something that does work, or you do a better job of the grounding. Well, you're one or the other. I've had any number of parents over the years try to explain to me why it was impossible for them to discipline their children. I don't get that. You want some ideas? Maybe you should write this down. Yeah, I'll give you some notes. If you really want me to help, I'll help. I'll give you as much help as you want on this subject, because I have to deal with these children, you know, and I see what's going on. Now, it's really easy to parent other people's kids. I appreciate that. But when there is no effort made, no significant effort made to discipline the child, then the foolishness is going to stay there. I mean, it's going to have to stay there. Trusting the child to get rid of it himself is just not a very reasonable way of looking at your life. Parents' job is to save their child's life, particularly when he doesn't want to be saved. Your child's drowning in the swimming pool because he wanted to get in the swimming pool. He doesn't know what he's doing, and he's going to kill himself in there. And so you say, well, kid, good luck to you. But you make your own choices at 7 years old, and this may not have been the best one. But you know what? Who am I to say? No, you jump in there and you save the child, right? The child, no, I don't want to stay in the pool. No, well, you're not going to stay in the pool. In fact, you're not going to get in the pool for a while. And I'm going to put a fence up to keep you out of the pool if necessary. I'm going to save your life whether you want to be saved or not. And God bless parents who have similar attitudes toward their children in their spiritual destruction. They seem to be determined to pursue in their own life. A couple of other related ones here. Proverbs 30, verse number 20, 18 through 20. And I'll quote a little piece of it up here. The text says here in verse number 18, there are three things which are too wonderful for me. And I think and it says four which I do not understand. And I think the first three are set up the fourth one. That's a common tactic in the Bible. The way of an eagle in the sky, the way of a serpent on a rock, the way of a ship in the middle of the sea, and the way of a man with a maid. In a different context, I might get more specific about what that means. You'll be grateful to hear that I'm not going to get more specific than that here. But basically what we're saying is that there are certain aspects to the relationship between men and women that are among the most magnificent things that God ever created. Some of the best things about human beings have to do with husbands and wives. It's a wonderful thing, and it should be glorious. The proper relationship is one of the great joys of this life. Now, this is the way that it should be. Now, read one more verse with me. Look at verse number 20. This is the way of an adulterous woman. She eats and wipes her mouth and says, I've done no wrong. Now, I said before that Proverbs, generally speaking, don't have a context. There are exceptions, and this is one of them. There is a glorious association between men and women, and there is a perversion of that that has been introduced by the devil and promulgated among sinful people, and that worms its way every single generation into the Lord's church. It is not nearly as glorious. It is not nearly as beautiful. It may seem better in the short term, but it is not. It is a carnal thing. It is an ugly thing. and ultimately is going to be a source of destruction here. I love the imagery here. She eats, she wipes her mouth, and says, I've done no wrong. I have destroyed this person's life, and I don't care. I realize that's an extreme way of looking at things. Not every adulteress is like that. Not every adulterer is like that. But ultimately, we're talking about selfish behavior. And we're supposed to avoid selfish behavior. We're supposed to avoid self, shallow, physical only behavior. We should be looking for things that are more noble than that. The adulterous woman that he mentions here comes up several times in the book, and we're not going to turn to all of them, but I'll refer you to one, at least, in chapter 5 and verses 1 through 6. The young reader of Proverbs is exhorted over and over again, especially in the first 9 chapters, to avoid this woman. And this isn't because Solomon hated women. Solomon loved women. But Solomon knew something about women, and he knew that his own personal association with women was at best checkered, and that he had caused himself a great deal of pain over the years, and I think that's one of the motivations behind this book. Verse 1, my son, give attention to my wisdom. Incline my ear to my understanding, your ear to my understanding, that you may observe discretion, and that your lips may reserve knowledge. For the lips of an adulteress drip honey, and smoother than oil is her speech. But in the end she is bitter as wormwood, sharp as a two-edged sword. Her feet go down to death, her steps take hold of Sheol. She does not ponder the path of life, her ways are unstable, she does not know it. The way the New American Standard Bible reads here. And the old phrase, do as I say, not as I do, comes up to mind. For those who know a little bit about Solomon's life here, all of us as parents have probably said or at least thought it from time to time. Please don't make the mistakes I made when I was younger, when I was your age. That's what Solomon is saying here. He knows the consequences of bad choices, especially regarding the opposite sex here. This adulterous woman is not appealing to what is real in you. She's not appealing to your soul. She's not appealing to your spirit. She's appealing to the flesh, and fleshly men are going to fall prey to this. Do not be one of those men. And you can change the sexes around here and make it work just as well in our modern day, I'm afraid to say. Now, this is not just a lesson about sex. This is not just a lesson about marriage. This is talking about a life choice. The sin that you welcome into your life, regardless of what form it takes, adultery or anything else, the sin that you choose for your lifestyle choice will destroy you in due course of time. Maybe not in your flesh, but certainly in your spirit, and oftentimes in your flesh. Chapter 7. In verse number 21, the adulteress is brought up again with her many persuasions. She entices him, this young, naive man here who's making the wrong choice. With her flattering lips, she seduces him. Suddenly he follows her as an ox goes to the slaughter, or as one in fetters to the discipline of a fool, until an arrow pierces through his liver, as a bird hastens to the snare, so he does not know that it will cost him his life. Now, therefore, my son, listen to me. He goes on to say in verse number 24, listen to me. Don't do this. Make better choices than this. Realize that there is a wonderful thing that is offered to you, and there is a horrible thing that is offered to you. More about this in the next step here. But what we need to do is make sure that we are valuing the things that are truly valuable in this life. Chapter 2 and verse number 1 and following. My son, if you'll receive my words and treasure my commandments within you, make your heart, your ear attentive to wisdom, incline your heart to understanding. For if you cry for discernment, lift your voice for understanding. If you seek her as silver and treasure, search for her as hidden treasures, then you will discern the fear of the Lord and understand the knowledge of God. For the Lord gives wisdom. From his mouth comes understanding. Go through verse number 6 there. This is a blessing that God has given you, the opportunity to search for wisdom, to search for higher things. And this isn't just talking about young single men. This is talking about all of us. And that kind of leads us into what I think is the last point that I was going to make here from chapter 31 and verse number 30. And I'll read this, and before I do, I want to emphasize, those of you who know chapter 31 of Proverbs, and all the ladies know, because if you've ever been in a ladies' class, you study about Proverbs 31. And I get that, and that's a good thing. You ought to be studying this. You ought to be studying it a lot. Men ought to be studying it. There is a portrait that is painted for us there of a woman that makes women very, very frustrated, right? Because she's perfect. She does everything right. She's excellent at everything. Apparently, her day has more than 24 hours. Or she doesn't sleep. She's some kind of mutant or something. Because she takes care of all the laundry. She takes care of all the tailoring. She takes care of real estate transactions. She takes care of public relations for her husband. You know, child rearing, education, all these things. She's involved in all of it. She does it all great. And we hate her for it, right, ladies? Well, I trust we all understand that this is a glorified image that's given to us here. Okay, I'm not sure that there's ever been a woman who 24 hours a day looked like that woman. Except for my mom, of course. What it's saying there, this is the woman that you need to aspire to. And men, this is the woman that you need to aspire to find for yourself. Because she's going to make you look awfully good, and most of us need all the help that we can get. And I think that we use that passage for that purpose, and I think we need to continue to use it. But in the overall context of Proverbs, I think there's a bigger point that is going to be made here. The woman who fears the Lord, the text says, she shall be praised at the end of it. What we see here in chapter 31 is the conclusion of this discussion that comes up off and on throughout the book, especially in the first part, but it comes up again in chapter 30. This contrast between the woman of wisdom, that she's usually just called wisdom, and this adulteress that we were talking about, or the foreign woman, she's sometimes called, the one who is the contrast to wisdom. You basically have two choices. Young man, you're about to go out on a date, and there are two women who appear to be ready to say yes to your overtures, and one of them is just absolutely wonderful, and one of them is trying to kill you. Now, which one do you want to go? Well, I want to go with the one who wants to kill me. Oh, why is that? Well, because she's pretty and because she's easily available, and it seems like I'm going to get to the finish line a little bit faster than I'm going to get with this other girl. That's the way I want to go. Well, you do that, and you're going to destroy yourself. Well, under the circumstances, I don't care, because we know how the young men are. And the proverb writer is exhorting his reader, make a better choice than that. Go after wisdom. And it's not just a matter of who you want to marry in your life. It's what kind of lifestyle do you want? What kind of person do you want to be for the next 70 years of your life? This foreigner that we're reading about here that comes up from time to time is going to appeal through carnality. You read from some of this passage already. I'll go back to chapter 7, if you would, back up to verse number 10 or so. And behold, a woman comes to meet him, dressed as a harlot and cunning of heart. She is boisterous and rebellious. Her feet do not remain at home. She is now in the streets, now in the squares, and lurks by every corner. So she seizes him and kisses him. And with a brazen face, she says to him, I was due to offer peace offerings. Today I have paid my vows. Therefore I have come out to meet you, to seek your presence earnestly. And I have found you. I have spread my couch with coverings. And she goes on and on, talking about how wonderful a life she can provide for him for the next 20 minutes. It's going to be great. It's going to be the best life you can possibly imagine. And she's telling the truth, as far as that goes. And Solomon says, be aware of what you're buying here. Be aware of what kind of lifestyle you're buying into here. It's not just what woman do you want. It's what lifestyle do you want. Do you want a life partner that is all about carnality, about finding physical pleasure in the short term? Is that your life goal, to be as happy as you possibly can be for a very, very short period of time? Is that the kind of life that you want? Or do you want what wisdom offers? The woman that you meet in chapter 8 sounds very different. Now, there's some similarities. There's the open overture. And by the way, there's a bit of an exaggeration here. But generally speaking, I think it's fair to say that the difference between the broad path and the narrow path is not very difficult to figure out. This woman here that you read about in chapter 7, all her brazen overtures and such, the devil is telling you who he is. He is identifying himself to you. If you have your eyes open, if you have your values straight, you'll be able to make this choice. You can do this. And wisdom is just the same. Does not wisdom call, verse number 1, chapter 8, and understanding lift up her voice on top of the heights beside the way where the paths meet? She takes her stand beside the gates at the opening of the city, at the entrance of the door. She cries out, to you, O men, I call, and my voice is to the sons of men. O naive ones, understand prudence, and O fools, understand wisdom. Listen, for I will speak noble things, and the opening of my lips will reveal right things. For my mouth will utter truth, and wickedness is an abomination to my lips. All the utterances of my mouth are in righteousness. There is nothing crooked or perverted in them. They are all straightforward to him who understands, and right to those who find knowledge. Take my instruction and not silver, and knowledge rather than choicest gold. For wisdom is better than jewels, and all desirable things cannot compare with her. Going through verse number 11 there. Again, the one who understands, the one who's seeking after knowledge, the one who aspires to wisdom as God has defined wisdom, you can do this. You can find this woman. She's trying to find you. She has identified herself to you. And if you can find your way to her, if you can direct your value system to be the kind of person where you aspire to this kind of lifestyle, where this is what appeals to you, then this quest for wisdom ultimately will lead you to what is described here in Proverbs numerous times and many other places as the fear of the Lord. Verse number 1, we started with this, right? The whole book of Proverbs basically tells us what Solomon means in chapter 1, verse 7. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge. Fools despise instruction and wisdom. You can do either one. You can regard, you can revere God's wisdom because you fear him, because you realize that he is better at directing your life. Or you can go your own way and you can chafe every time somebody tries to drag you back into the straight and narrow. That's your choice. You get to choose a date. You get to choose a life partner. Make the right choice. And I think that's what the deeper meaning, if you will, of Proverbs 31, the latter part of Proverbs 31 is talking about. Here is God's idea of a marriage partner. Here's God's idea of a life mate. Marry wisdom. That's who you need to be looking for. Male or female, doesn't matter. Especially if you're young, but if you haven't gotten around making this decision when you're in your 40s or 50s or 60s, make it now by all means. Better late than never. Realize the choice that you have and the importance, the vital nature of this choice. And choose wisdom. It's not going to be as frilly. It's not going to have as many tingles necessarily. It may not have the same kind of appeal in the short term. It's certainly not going to have the same kind of appeal in the short term. And an awful lot of your friends out there in the world may be going exactly the opposite direction. That's what I'm suggesting you take, what Solomon is suggesting you take today. But if you will dig deeper than that, and if you will find the value in the things of God, if you'll find the fear of the Lord, that is going to be the life partner that will take you through every relationship, every circumstance, every choice that you make from the rest of your life. Career counseling, marriage, where to live, rearing your children, godly behavior, what to do on a Friday night, all of it gets covered by the same thing. Fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge. If you can make that one choice right, you set yourself up to make every other choice in your life right as well. For the person of knowledge, for the person of wisdom, that should be an appeal that is just too good to reject. That's the best I can do. It's selling you on the values of wisdom. You can buy it or not buy it. Clearly, a lot of people don't. And if I've misrepresented the Bible in some way, please, by all means, let me know about that. But if I have not, if this is, in fact, the choice that you have in front of you, wisdom or the foreign woman, choose wisdom. Choose God in every aspect of your life. And take this knowledge into the Proverbs, take it into the gospel accounts, into Acts, into all the rest of the scriptures, so that you'll know how to live in the fear of the Lord and how to please him in every aspect of your life. I hope this has been instructive. If it has, maybe we'll do it again sometime. But in any case, We're going to offer the Lord's invitation to those who need to respond to it. If you are ready to make the fear of the Lord your rule of life, if you're ready to be baptized in water for remission of sins, we are eager to help you in whatever way we possibly can. If there's something we can do to help you walk with Christ, to help you walk more perfectly in Christ, and to encourage you along the way, please respond to the invitation while we stand and sing this time.